Services Committee to order at 1:06 p.m. on Wednesday, March 13th. Present with us so far, Representative Tuck, Representative Hawker, Co-Chair Feige, Representative Seaton, and Co-Chair Sadler. Other folks missing have given their reasons why. We anticipate some of them will be with us shortly. Anybody else in the audience that we should recognize? Hello, friends and neighbors. Please turn your cell phones to silent, as there are dire vegetable consequences for failure to do so. And we do have two items on our agenda today. First up is HB 89, the aquatic invasive species, and we'll do that for about up to 45 minutes, and then we'll turn to House Bill 158, the DNR hunting concession program bill, for the remainder of the meeting. I would advise anybody in the meeting, in the room, who wants to testify to please sign up in the sheet outside at the table. I understand we have folks lining up online to testify, and with your indulgence, we'll go through the first bill and then get to yours. So with that, Representative Seaton, you can present from your seat or at the Chair of Infamy, if you'd like, whichever your preference is. House Bill 89, Representative Seaton.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 89 is a rapid response bill for aquatic invasive species. We have a very important issue with aquatic invasives threatening a lot of Alaska economy. And from all areas of the state, we might notice that Alodia is in South Central, Sand Lake, and other areas, as well as in Fairbanks. It overruns salmon habitat. Pike have established in the Susitna drainage, especially in some on the Kenai Peninsula. DVEX was probably the issue that in the last legislature stimulated our attention the most, because that was developed in Whiting Harbor, which is by Sitka, and yet it was taking so long to get around to doing anything about it that could threaten the entire Sitka Sound herring fishery, because if you had this invasive species there, you wouldn't be, which is basically a tunicate, which is stringy and just smothers rocks and everything, but you couldn't have seiners go in and seine in those areas, and you wouldn't be able to have tenders pump those fish with some of that material, which would reseed other areas if they went to other harbors and delivered those herring. So could basically shut off a huge economic resource for the state. And then we have other threats like the European green crab and mussel species that are across the United States have clogged filters and waterways. So it's estimated that about $120 billion a year it costs the United States, and that's from the Fish and Wildlife Service estimate, and $29 million.
Is it $120 million?
$120 billion per year is the estimated loss by the Fish and Wildlife Service for the United States, and $9 million is spent on invasive species management in Alaska per year. That's between government and non-government groups, and that's according to ICER. The big problem is that once an invasive species is established, it's very difficult and very costly to control. And so one of the things that has held us up is not having ability and plans in place for rapid response when you have an incipient population. An incipient population is one that's newly discovered, which is just starting to grow. It hasn't become endemic throughout a watershed, but all of a sudden you're at a lake or you're along the coast and you find a population of an invasive species. If you can handle it right then, you can take care of it quickly. The problem has been that there are all these first of all, there's no money dedicated to that rapid response. And the other thing is that if there's any private property in the way, there's these questions of, well, do you have authority? What's the authority? How do you handle that? So those are the problems that HB 89 addresses. It gives the state agencies authority to act and prioritize in actions that will be effective. It provides this a rapid response fund so that there would be some amount of money dedicated, so you wouldn't have to be going around and saying, well, the legislature didn't authorize us to spend money on this particular problem, so do we have to wait until the next legislative session comes through? So that's what the rapid response fund is for, is implementing a plan. This bill also considers private property in the development of plans, protects subsistence, recreational, and commercial opportunities before it's too late by having an invasive species. So, anyway, this actually gives ADF&G and other state agencies the authorities and tools to rapidly respond to an incipient outbreak of aquatic species. And this bill is either freshwater or saltwater. And it requires ADF&G to coordinate with DEC, DNR, other private groups and private parties in the development of plans. So plans are in place for the type of, whether you'd have a plant invasive species, whether you have a tunicate or a crab, so that you get those things done ahead of time. Yes?
Good. You said tunicate? What's the word you're using?
Tunicate, which is a colonial tunicate. It's an animal that looks kind of like a coral, but it's soft, and it just expands and grows. You might think it's seaweed if you first looked at it, but it's actually a colonial animal, like a coral.
Okay, thank you.
But very soft, and generally the big problem with those is they're smothering. They just grow over the rocks. In fact, two of the varieties, one is called sea vomit, which is DVAX, and the other is rock snot, which is a lot, you know. And that's why one of the reasons why we have outlawed felt soles on waders is because the felt soles will pick up rock snot and take it to the next stream you're going to. So hopefully what we do is work on prevention. Prevention is cheap. Incipient population control is less cheap, but still cheap compared to having an established invasive species that you're now trying to control, because if it gets throughout a drainage, it's darn near impossible to get rid of. So the HB 89 gives the Fish and Game the authority to use the appropriate methods, whether that's chemical, biological, mechanical, or physical means, to take care, to deal with the outbreak, and expedited review of plans, and also sets prioritization for eradication of the species over other management issues. One of the other things that came up with the DVEX was you have some people around that want to harvest sea urchins. Well, gee, you have some sea urchins in this bay that has this incipient population. Yeah, there's sea urchins all along the coast, but can somebody challenge that if you're going to destroy the DVEX, the rock snot in that area, you're also going to kill some sea urchins, and therefore they could have a commercial interest. So this prioritizes that getting rid of the incipient population takes precedence over the other management portions for that same localized area. But it does require that the development of the plan considers the impact on native fish species as well, and giving due consideration to private property in the development of the plans. And again, the requirement is, as you develop the plans, you have to have the private property folks and other groups at the table in the development of those plans. So I guess the final two things is that the state agencies are held harmless. It requires that DNR, when they're giving permits for such things as mariculture, that one of the conditions on giving a permit is the people that receiving the permit or the lease recognize that if they have to come in and control invasive species, then the state is held harmless. State agents are held harmless from, you know, destruction of private property. Of course, you know, there have been some questions, and we did talk to Ledge Legal, and that would not extend to gross negligence or intentional misconduct. Okay. And then the last thing was, again, we established this rapid response fund so that there's a fund that there can be a pot of money in there that can be used, but it can't be used for planning. The planning is accomplished through the fiscal note of the bill. The rapid response fund is for implementing a plan when you have an incipient outbreak for control. And so, Mr. Chairman, that's what the bill does. It attempts to get us moving quickly instead of, like now it's been 3 years, going on 4 years for looking at the Sitka DVEX problem, and we need to get ahead of the game instead of being behind the game. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Questions from the committee or Representative Hawker?
Mr. Chair, if you could just indulge me a contextual comment here. I think this was another one of those bills. It was a really good bill that we saw through the most of the legislature last year with a couple of minor changes that I think are, they make actually really good substantive improvements over some clarification language in the bill. But, you know, last time it made it all the way to that infamous Senate Rules Committee where it died in the waning hours of the session, and I commiserate with its sponsor, and I certainly wish it well this year.
Thank you.
Good context.
And Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Chairman, last year we did this as a resource committee bill. It was easier this time with oil and gas and other issues, so to the forefront that we, you know, I did it as a personal bill, but it's basically the same bill that went through last year, and I appreciate the co-chair working out with me last year.
Thank you. Other, any questions? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Never underestimate the ability of Alaska fishermen to come up with very descriptive terms. It was normally referred to in a long, lengthy Latin description. I believe the legislative intent here, and correct me if I'm wrong, Representative Seaton, is this is for dealing with incipient populations, that is, invasive species that have gained a toehold somewhere within the state. Is my general understanding there correct?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, that's correct. And the term incipient, when we talked to Ledge Legal, they said we really didn't need to define that because it's a common dictionary term. You know, it's a first outbreak or it's a new outbreak of a species, even if that species is found in Alaska, but a, you know, occurrence that is new and growing, or you're catching it before it becomes endemic or widespread throughout a system.
Okay. And that was my next question was, do we need a definition? I don't think, based on that answer, that we do. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I have a question for you, sir. You touched on this a little bit, but does the bill address the impacts from agency contractors? If DNR or DEC or someone sublets some of their authority to a contractor, does it address impacts of contractors' action on private property?
Mr. Chairman, yes. If you look on page 2, it's line 19, and this was a comment from ADF&G. Originally, it says the state, its officers, employees, and agents of the state, which would be contractors, and you know, whether they, whatever the committee's wish is. So that was added in fisheries because it had been suggested by ADF&G that they would, you know, if they were contracting somebody, it didn't quite cover them. But that's up to the committee. If the committee wants to make a change on that, I'd be open to it.
I'm not seeing a great movement toward it, but just wanted to make sure and ask that question. I'll ask another question. This the focus here is on aquatic species. I know it's an area of interest to you. Does it pertain to terrestrial land-based invasive species as well?
Mr. Chairman, this only deals with aquatic, meaning freshwater aquatic and marine species. The Department of Agriculture already does have authority on terrestrial things, and there's weeds and noxious, I forget what the task force is, but it's noxious weeds and, or I can't remember the name of the task force, but there's a group that deals with that, and in fact they're one of the support, the Alaska Committee for Noxious and Invasive Plant Management, and you have a a new document that was provided where they are supporting the bill, and that's in there. So, but they've been dealing with the terrestrial as well as the Department of Agriculture.
Okay, thank you. Questions? I got a couple more if you don't mind. This bill creates the Aquatic Species Rapid Response Fund. What are the plans? How would you anticipate populating that fund with money?
Mr. Chairman, hopefully it would be enough to deal with an incipient population that would, you know, probably $1 million, $2 million, something like that, that we could actually accomplish the rapid response if it was between legislative sessions. This bill does not appropriate money to that fund. That would be a separate action by the legislature, whatever it would decide to do. And that's, you know, that conversation hasn't taken place as to how much needs to be in there to control or to start controlling an outbreak of an incipient population. Okay.
And this is would go to finance next, so that's
yes.
Okay. I'll ask another question. On page 2, line 10, there is a reference to activities related by the department in the area where incipient population is being targeted. Can you give us any sideboards as to how big an area is, or what the, in this context, what area would be defined as?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. That discussion has been left to the department. Kind of the idea of an incipient population is going to have some control over that. If it's too broad an area, of course, it's going to be an endemic population. And so it wouldn't be an incipient population. The idea here was that giving priority over other activities regulated by the department. That was like where I was talking about whether you had a sea urchin fishery or a sea cucumber fishery, and probably you'd be talking about a portion of a bay, and it has to be localized enough to be an incipient population. It's not meaning that you have to stop all management in a management area. It just means within the localized area where you are having a control plan activated, then it would give the control plan priority over your normal management of fish species within that localized area where your plan is being put in place.
Okay. And how would the prioritization, if there was a crisis like a ship sinks, releasing diesel fuel, there's an oil spill or something, how would the response to invasive species outbreak be prioritized alongside that kind of oil spill, for example?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that they would correspond really at all, because this is where Fish and Game has management authority over its prioritizations of its other activities regulated by Fish and Game. So this is trying to get to the dueling of you've got a bunch of different species, and you have a bunch of different openings and closings. Harvests that could be taking place, and so that wouldn't deal with something like DEC and a ship sinking dealing with a fuel contamination, because ADF and G, that's not under their management control.
Good deal. I've taken a lot of questions. Questions from the committee, or I should also make for the record note that we do have Deputy Commissioner Fogels from DNR for questions, and the Director of Sport Fish, Charles Swanton, is also available, I think, in person, if there are questions. Seeing no other questions, I guess I've monopolized that conversation long enough. I will ask if there's anyone else who wants to testify on the legislation, either in person. Okay, great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McKean, President of Cordova District Fishermen United, which I represent for this purpose. Last year, during the net fishing on the Copper River and the Prince William Sound, we started to see a lot of Japanese debris coming in, and we have a lot of debris still left of Montague and Kayak Island on the outside. So I contacted NOAA, because that's part of their responsibility too, but part of this is what I like to see, and I don't quite see in the bill, but I don't know if you could stick it in there, but on the marine side of this, I'm being told there's going to be a lot of more Japanese debris coming for the next 2 years. And last year we had a hotline for the fishermen to call in of any debris they seen, but some of this debris wasn't checked for invasive species. So I would like to see a couple things, Mr. Chairman, and one is also coordinate with NOAA, because they're trying to establish money for cleanup on the beaches. but we would want somebody from the state or from Fish and Game to be there to make sure there's not any invasive species on some of this stuff, especially the larger things. We had a van floating around, couldn't locate it again, it must have sunk. But there was a lot of bottles and buoys and baskets and different things that came over, so we're not so sure that there isn't something out there on those beaches. So we'd like to see that, and I'll do my part in establishing another hotline with NOAA and DNR or Fish and Game for next year to see what shows up again. But we're being told there's going to be a lot more debris on the beaches, and certainly the long-term plan would probably have to include something about checking that before they clean it up for invasive species. So that was my concern. And the way the bill's kind of laid out, I guess you could probably include that or talk to the different agencies about that, but that would be my concern, and we support the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for Ms. McCune?
Thank you, sir. Let's see, is anybody, I think we have one person online to testify in this. Can we go online to Chris Rainwater in Homer?
Yeah, thank you, members of the committee. Chris Rainwater, Homer. Just to tell you that I'm in favor of your bill. It's coming right along. I'm with the Conservation District here, and we've been working with these invasives in the uplands and the agricultural community for about 6 years, and we've had some luck. But I was just going to tell you, though, it takes some time to put these procedures together that work well, and I'm looking forward to even assisting with this one in the marine and in the aquatics. We think we may have Elodia in a couple of our lakes here around Homer, because it seems that float planes pack this Elodia plant around, and so the Conservation Districts of Alaska are going to investigate the float plane lakes within their boundaries this summer. And maybe we can get a handle on that. I appreciate you guys' efforts, and that's all from Homer.
Thank you, Mr. Rainwater. I appreciate that. Any questions for Mr. Question for the sponsor, actually. Mr. McCune raised the question of coordination with federal officials. Would you be able to accommodate that? Do you think the bill does that, or would it need changes to accomplish that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, on page one, if you'll look under on line seven, or six and seven, it says the department shall, in cooperation with Department of Environmental Conservation, Department of Natural Resources, and other state, federal, public, and private entities, establish a rapid response and management plan for addressing incipient populations. So I think that it is covered in there. It's a requirement that they contact federal agencies, the appropriate agencies, because they shall, in cooperation with these others, develop the plan. Now, this isn't saying that we have to have the federal government in each one of these cases be involved in the response to the plan, but in the development of the plan, which is the important part for everybody's input to come to the table. That's actually a requirement.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Thank you, Representative Seaton. Okay, I think I neglected technically to open public testimony, so for the record, note that public testimony continues to be open, and invite anybody else who's present or online to testify on this.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative.
Might I just ask, we have Ed Fogel here, and he had some questions. We just wanted to make sure that it was on the record of what the intention was, is that this is a rapid response, incipient populations. If there's an endemic population, that's going to... So this is kind of like a war and a battle. This is a tactical battle when you have an incipient population. An endemic population, you're going to have a war. You're going to have a really strong battle plan. And so just wanted to clarify and wanted to make sure that it was clear enough to the department of what was the intention for the rapid response and the rapid response plans. So,
great. So if we can get Deputy Commissioner Fogel on the record here to make that clear. And for the record, we've been joined much earlier by Representative Tarr, and Representative Johnson has joined us. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ed Fogel, Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. Yeah, we've been looking at this bill, and as Representative Seaton said, the war on invasives is a battle. It's big. We have the Department of Natural Resources has its own strategic plan, primarily focused on terrestrials, weeds, and agricultural pests, although Lodeo is becoming rapidly part of that, and we've put together an MOU that was signed by Fish and Game, DEC, and DNR in January of this year that kind of gives the DNR the lead responsibility for coordinating the Lodeo and freshwater aquatic invasive battle. This bill, what it does is it establishes the Quick Response Fund, which is one part of that battle. And I think our strategic plan actually has one of the many chapters is on quick response and how important that is, because the costs are much lower to eradicate in the quick response before a population is really caught hold. So, yeah, that's clear to us at this point. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Actually, Deputy Commissioner, I got a question for you, too. I actually went to school in a place where there's a species called kudzu, which was imported to control erosion, and it does that in Howe, and it's pretty much taken over the ecosystem down in Georgia. But has there ever been in the literature any experience in which once an invasive species got a toehold and became endemic, it has been successfully fought back or eradicated? Has that war ever been won?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know the answer to that question. I really don't. I'd have to ask some staff and get back to you. Nothing pops into my head as a success story. I don't know. Maybe Representative Seaton and his staff have been doing a lot of research, too, if they have any ideas. But I don't at this point.
Seaton, if you can answer that one.
Well, it depends on where you are. I mean, we have rabbits in Australia. There are some attempts and some bad solutions that then get corrected, so it's better not to have the introductions to begin with. But it's been fought around the world.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Mr. Fogles.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just recall that I know that there are some success stories on eradication of rats on some of the islands. Oh. Maybe out in the Aleutians. So.
Okay, good deal. But it's easier certainly to fight the battle on the beachhead and not have to fight the war. We've been joined by Representative Wilson, who was in a leadership meeting, so thank you for your honor. Good. Other questions for Mr. Fogles? Any other public testimony? If not, I will close public testimony on HB 89 and ask the... actually, Representative Johnson, you had to express some concern about one little piece of language on this bill. I don't know if you want to raise that issue at this point, or...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I apologize for my tardiness. I was in another meeting. Not as important as this one, of course, but... On page 2, line 18 and 19, I'm a little concerned about the term employees and agents. I just don't know how broad that is, and I was in contact late yesterday afternoon with the department, and they said they didn't have a lot of problems with removing agents. So I don't know what the will of the committee is. I don't know how significant it is, but I would be prepared to maybe offer a conceptual amendment to delete employees and agents and just put employees. I don't have a problem with identifying employees, but sometimes I don't want to necessarily go out and give everyone that we contract with that kind of ability.
Okay.
So that would be, and I would certainly understand that this is not within the parameters of the notice for amendments and could make it conceptual. I would be happy to maybe look at it in another committee. So but that's my concern. I just want to make sure we're not too broad with who we give certain powers to.
I'm willing to entertain that as conceptual amendment one. Would the sponsor have any objection to deleting the words and agents and having just be officers and employees on page 2, line 18, 19?
Thank you. Just for clarification, Mr. Chairman. So we're just on line 19 taking the word and agents out. Basically as a conceptual amendment, and then they will, is that correct?
Well, and the way I had it actually written was employees and agents, and then add back employees, so you're absolutely right, just taking out agents would be the only thing that it effectively does.
So as a conceptual amendment, I don't have any problems with that, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Any objection to the amendment by the rest of the committee?
So do we need to move it, or are we just going to...
Oh, I thought you had, please.
No, I'd like to move conceptual amendment number one.
Concession amendment one has been offered to delete the words and agents on page 2, line 19,
such that we'll now read the state, on line 18, all relevant leases and permits provision that the state and the officers and employees of the state. That's correct?
That's correct.
Is there any objection by the committee?
And Mr. Chairman, I might, if I could, like to certainly give any, this was somewhat drafted rather quickly, so give Ledge Legal the ability to make any grammatic changes that they might make, and that's part of a conceptual amendment. It would be very clear that commas and apostrophes are not my forte.
Commas count. They do.
Commas count. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good deal. Seeing no objection, conceptual amendment one is adopted. Any other wrap-up comments, Representative Seaton?
I don't. I see Representative Hawker. I don't have any.
We are in discussion of the bill, sir.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. With apologies, and I'm just doing, I guess, public business on the record here. I've not had a chance to talk with the sponsor or yourself on this, but I was looking through the fiscal note, and, you know, when it involves three temporary people at Sport Fish and one temporary person for a year over agriculture, relatively benign fiscal notes. However, they are fiscal notes. You have to remember that fiscal notes are, in fact, appropriations. They are approved later and become part of our operating budget here. If it pleased the chair and with the concurrence of the sponsor of the bill, it would be my personal preference that we zero out these fiscal notes coming out of this committee, as it does have a subsequent finance referral because of the existence of the fiscal notes. And I would much rather have the agency have to argue the numbers back into the bill in front of the finance committee than have someone up there have to come back ahead and try to argue them back down. I'd much rather see a more thorough explanation in the finance committee and a rationalization justification for the fiscal notes. And we have the ability to inspire that conversation by zeroing the fiscal notes. But it's if and only if it is at the will of the chair.
Take a brief at ease. Representative Seaton, do you have an objection to that procedure?
Mr. Chairman, I would just want to make sure that it wasn't interpreted that zeroing a fiscal note would be attempting to not have it go to finance. I just want to put that on the record. I don't think that that's the intent, but if things go with zero fiscal notes, I want to make sure that, I mean, I think it needs to go to finance committee, and so I just want to make sure that that's wouldn't be the effect of zeroing out the fiscal notes. And other than that, I'm not with finance committee, so I don't know where we are.
Thank you, Representative. So with the understanding that it would be the intent of the committee that this bill would go to finance for consideration, and the argument and defense of the fiscal notes numbers would be part of that, that'd be okay with me, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And it would take a floor action by the Speaker to remove that referral. And I think a conversation with the Speaker that we do not wish that to happen would be good enough, and I think that since it already has a referral, it's a no action action to send it to finance.
Okay. Thanks to the rules chair on committee. So
sometimes.
Fair enough. So procedurally, I'm sorry, you need to make that motion. It was
Mr. Chair, if I might put on the record,
Representative Hawker, thank you.
I would move and ask unanimous consent of this committee that fiscal note number 4 and 5 be zeroed out, and that would result in all the fiscal notes attached with this bill are now a zero fiscal note, but again, also with the very clear assumption, or excuse me, the very clear intent that by zeroing these out, we do not in any way intend that the bill misses its little trip up through the finance committee.
Fair enough. Is your objection to the motion to zero the fiscal notes, 4 and 5?
I'll object for discussion.
Great discussion.
The numbers are being zeroed out. The language is not being zeroed out. Is that correct? I mean, there is second pages that have languages. Are those being?
Representative Hawker.
Mr. Chairman, I would take that as a friendly amendment to the amendment to zero out the fiscal notes, that we leave the language discussion in the fiscal notes, but we reduced them to zero, which means there would be zero money associated with the moving of this bill out of this committee. And should the sport fish folk and the ag folk want to get something into this year's budget, they've got to go to finance and argue for it.
Very good. With that clarification, I don't think it takes an amendment, but with that clarification. Seeing no other objection, okay, that moves, so they're zeroed out, and which brings the bill before us. What's the will of the committee? Representative P. Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move House Bill 89, version N, as amended, with attached zeroed fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
No objection? Okay, so passes. We'll take a brief at ease. And actually, you know what? Let's be in interest of time. We have a lot of people here to testify on the following bill. Let's just pass that committee report around for signing as we proceed. Take a brief at ease while we swap the gavel.
Back in session, we will start to hear public testimony on House Bill 158. We will proceed in the order of folks that have traveled to Juneau to testify. We have four of those folks in the room, and then we will go to the LIOs and then to the off-net. We have a total of currently about 26 folks that want to testify, so I'm going to ask that people limit their testimony to under 3 minutes. And what's that?
Yeah.
Under 3 minutes, and we'll try to get through as many as we can. For those of you that are guides, I ask that you, when you state your name for the record, that you mention your guide number. The number of hunts that you've contracted on average, just a ballpark number, and the percentage of income, not the income, but the percentage of your income that you derive from guiding. So with that, we'll open up with Mr. Wayne Kubek.
Hello, Resources Committee, Chair, and others. Thank you for your hard work on this effort. I'm Wayne Kubat. I have lived in Alaska for 37 years and hold Master Guide License number 147. I conduct, on average, the last 3 years, 8 to 10 to 12 hunts per year. They're full-service hunts, 12 to 15 days long. It's about 60 to 70% of my income. I became an assistant guide in 1981, earned my registered guide license in 1986, and joined the Alaska Professional Hunters Association that same year as a professional member. I started my own guide business, Alaska Remote Guide Service, in 1987. I also served on the Mattsu Valley Fish and Game Advisory Committee from 1998 to 2007, and chaired the committee the last four of those years. I'm also a board of directors member for the Alaska Professional Hunters Association, APHA for short, and was elected last December to that position. This is the first time of the 37 years that I've lived in Alaska that I've ever come to Juneau. This bill is important to me. I'm here to testify in favor of HB 158 that will allow DNR to establish a guide concession program. Many members of the people who oppose this concession plan are trying to paint this as a David and Goliath battle, with them being David and APHA guides being Goliath. The DNR plan is certainly a limiting plan, but I don't see APHA guides faring any better as a group than most others in the prospectus process. Yet most of us are willing to risk some sacrifice in the short term in hopes of stability and viability for the industry down the road. There are roughly, you heard in testimony on Monday, there are roughly 1,400 licensed guides of various levels in Alaska. About 550 of those are registered or master guides and can conduct hunts. And of those 550, only 312 contracted at least one hunt last year. APHA professional membership averages about 125 members a year, or about a third of the number of people that contracted hunts last year. However, research has been done in the past which shows that our membership conducts about 50 to 70% of the number of guided hunts in any one year. Our board of directors held a teleconference with all of our professional members in January, and 45 participated online. We spent several hours. Support for the final version of the DNR guide concession plan wasn't unanimous, but it was a very strong majority. As a result, APHA's nine-member board of directors voted unanimously to support the guide concession plan, and subsequently are in support of HB 158 to authorize DNR to implement the program. When the state passes out other professional licenses, such as pharmacists, hairdressers, etc., to my knowledge, they don't provide free office space for those people. They allow them to work in that industry. Kind of seems to me that that's what the state is doing by allowing anybody with a guide license to operate in up to three guide use areas on state land for virtually no cost at all. I feel this policy is hurting Alaska's wildlife resource, and I think it's hurting the quality of experience for multiple thousands of Alaska resident hunters and residents of Alaska as a whole. There's 300 guides that contracted hunts last year that are disagreeing whether this is going to put them out of business or be good for business down the road, but there's multiple thousands of Alaska resident hunters to consider this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cuba. I appreciate your testimony. Next up, Atlin Doherty.
Hello, my name is Atlin Doherty. Thank you for your time. I'm a registered guide, 1250, and started guiding when I was 18 years old. I'm now 28, and born and raised in Juneau, third generation Alaskan commercial fisherman, and big game guide. I've been fortunate to guide in most of the major regions of the state, Southeast, Kodiak, Alaska Peninsula, Western Alaska, Unit 20, Central Alaska Range, the Arctic, both north and south side. So I've been able to see a lot of the state, both federal and state lands, guided on them. And I'll have to say that the federal lands are, with the concession areas, are far better than the state lands. And I would sure like to see this program go through. This, in my opinion, has to happen for the younger guides that want a sustainable long-term industry. And I sure hope that you guys give the DNR the tools and to make this program happen.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Doherty. Appreciate your testimony. Questions for Mr. Doherty?
Percentage of
yeah, just two pieces of information. Number of hunts contracted on average?
I just assist other outfitters.
Assistant guide, okay.
Yeah.
And then so your percentage of income derived from guiding?
I'd say about 20%.
Okay. Very good.
Yep.
Thanks, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck in the future. Next up, Lyle Becker.
Hello, committee members. Thank you for hearing me. My name is Lyle Becker. I live in Anchorage. My guide number is 1276. I got my assistant guide license in 2006 and tested for my registered in 2009. I guide about 8 to 10 clients per year, and about 70% of my annual income comes from guiding activities. And as an additional note, I spend about 90 to 100 nights a year in a sleeping bag on the ground. You might want to add that in on your list, too. I say I guide 8 to 10 clients per year, but I don't write hunt contracts either. I'm a registered guide. I could write those contracts, but I don't. I'll get to that in just a second. I started working as a full registered guide on state land in 2006 in Unit 14A, which was a sheep hunt at the time. And I noticed right away that the area was overrun with guides and with hunters. And just 2 years later, that same area went to a draw. So my initial experience in guiding was an area that was really overcrowded. Again, that was on state land. But I learned my lesson right from the beginning that state land is really not the place for me long-term to try to look at putting much investment into. And so immediately thereafter, I started looking for people to work for on federal land where there was a limited entry system where I could long-term try to make a niche out for myself. I couldn't look a client in the eye and tell them, I can provide you with a quality hunt, even though I'm legally allowed to do it on state land. I just could not do that. Since then, I've devoted all my time to federal land, and last year, the rotation for permits on federal land came up. I applied for an area, and I got a small area. So I guess I would be a bit of a case study for if a young guy wanted to commit to an area, follow the rules, and try to keep his nose clean, he can reap the benefits of it. I'm 33 years old, just turned 33, so obviously I haven't been in the industry that long, but I've committed to making it a major part of my livelihood. It's my vocation. I think if this plan went through, I think if the commissioner were allowed to do this and we could follow through with some type of plan, we would definitely reduce user conflicts in the field with resident hunters. That's a major concern. We could hopefully prevent making some areas go to drawing areas, like in Unit 14 happen. And then also it would be long-term, much better quality experience for anybody that wants to commit themselves to this vocation. That's all I have. If you have any questions, I'll try to answer.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Becker. Representative Seaton, quick question.
Thank you. How, if, are we just taking less animals or... you're saying there's less conflict with resident hunters. So I'm trying to figure out if you're saying that if there is the limited entry system, you're just going to take less animals or what?
That is part of it. I mean, in some area, statewide, different areas obviously have different user impact complications. The areas I've been in where there were a lot of guides in a small area, yes, those areas would have less animals taken. But another big component of minimizing user conflicts, especially with resident hunters, would be that the resident hunter could know up front, I would like to commit myself to hunting in this area. You know, my family has been hunting in this area for a long time, and I know ahead of time there's only one guide in there or there's only two guides in there. I know who they are, and I've got some idea up front of how many people they're going to be guiding. So as it currently stands in state land, it's whoever fills out the paperwork and wants to take a client into some areas can do that. So theoretically, you could have 100 people land in one valley or on one landing strip. Obviously, that's not happening, but that could happen. If some system like this were implemented, the resident hunter would know up front, okay, they've curtailed that somewhat, and I know up front how many tags they're allocated.
Representative?
I'm sorry, did that answer your question?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the current sort of proposal, the document we've been given says that there'd likely be 208 full concessions, 90 limited concessions. Just trying to understand, the one criticism I've heard about this bill is that it would be harder for some of the more independent guides to participate. And you know, if this program were implemented, do you see yourself continuing to work as an assistant guide for someone, or would you go on to apply for one of these concessions, and which one, if you know?
Yeah, thank you for asking. No, actually, my goal is to be self-sustaining and to be the contracting guide on my own areas. In the long run, no, I wouldn't keep subcontracting myself to other people, but that's the reason I invested myself on federal land. And now that I've got a small federal area, I'll be able to do that in that one area. It's a three brown bear, two moose a year area. So it's not enough to sustain me year long. But little by little, I would hope to acquire small concessions like that, yes.
Thanks. Okay. And last question, Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As an assistant guide, you're working underneath a master guide, for lack of a better term. Are you limited to just hunting where that one master guide is, or is it easy to transfer from one master guide to another master guide to be able to hunt different animals in different areas?
Right. Clarification on a term. A master guide or a registered guide can write a hunt contract, and they're limited to three areas statewide, so every year they have to declare where they're going to hunt. As an assistant guide, or if your registered guide functioning as an assistant guide, as I've been doing, you know, you shift around. So in any one year, there have been some years where I've worked for up to six different contracting guides. So I've subbed myself out to different people. As the season closes in this part of the state, a different season is opening over here. So I'll shift over to someone else, and that's very common. People that have a quote-unquote normal full-time job usually can't do that. There are a lot of assistant guides that like to guide as a sideline, and so they'll only spend a smaller amount of time of the year guiding for one person in one area. But those of us that have tried to make it a major part of our career will move around.
And just one quick follow-up.
Quick follow-up.
Can anyone apply for assistant guide?
There are some minimum qualifications, and this has been in flux with these minimum qualifications. But in summary, if you have a first aid card, a clean and clear violation record, you haven't committed any violations, and then you meet a minimum requirement of time that you've spent hunting in the state of Alaska. If I'm correct, it's been several years since I applied for it, and it has actually changed somewhat since then, but it used to be 60 days in the field, and then you had to have hunted at least one big game animal during that time, and then they changed it to where you had to actually harvest a big game animal yourself. And there are some folks in the back of the room that could clear this up, but I believe this winter that qualification was dropped. You no longer have to actually harvest a big game animal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Becker. Next up will be is it really quick?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you a member of the association?
I am a member of the APHA, yes. I'm not a board member, but I'm just a member.
I hope that each person that comes up will say whether they're a member of the association or not. That just helps us in our thought process.
Okay, next up, Henry Tiffany from Esker, Alaska.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Henry Tiffany. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've resided in Anchorage and Juneau and been in Fairbanks for the last 24 or 25 years. I'm proud to sit here and tell you that I'm a master guide. I was fortunate as a young man to find a vocation and a profession that just ignited a passion in me, and I pursued it. It was not with instant gratification that we are satisfied in today's age with texts and emails. I did not one morning wake up and decide to be a hunting guide and the next week run my own show. It took a lot of time, a lot of dedication, and I learned a lot from some wonderful people in our state who are still guiding today. And that is a process that I found valuable, and I'm proud to have gone through it. I'm in full support of House Bill 158. I have been in support of this process since we as an industry basically went to DNR and declared a problem on state land. I received the majority of my income from guiding. And for clarification, as you asked, my guide license number is Master Guide 144. Not only is it a profession, it is a passion. I am still in the field guiding someone anytime one of the guides that works with me is in the field. I'm pleased. The guides that work with me are all Alaskans. The vast majority, if not all, of the income that is derived from a visiting hunter to one of my camps stays in Alaska somehow, one way or the other. There are many user groups in our state that enjoy our lands and our resources. And I want to make it very clear that in no way does a program such as this negatively affect a resident hunter. Where they hunt today, they could go and hunt tomorrow. The only difference that they might see is that there might not be quite as many people there. And as a resident hunter myself, I know when I go afield, the fewer people I see, the better the experience. If I happen to see game, that's a wonderful bonus. But certainly seeing fewer people is a real benefit to my experience in the field, and I think to all Alaskans. So with a program like this, there would be less people in the field, and but it would not restrict a resident hunter from going wherever they have traditionally gone or would like to go. And I think a program such as this could be of real benefit to many of the rural communities in our state. I know many guides themselves and their families utilize all of the meat that they and their families can harvest, as does mine. But it is too much, and we give back to those rural communities. And I think having the continuity of knowing which guide is hunting around a specific region or village, and if there is a problem, something seems amiss, they can go to that guide or those couple of guides and say, we've noticed a problem here. It, versus right now, there could be so many guides there, they don't know who to contact. And secondly, bringing the income to our state, if this were to go to a draw, which would be the death of legitimate professional guiding, in my opinion, it would become, the majority of the income would go to booking agents and companies that already exist, such as Cabela's and such, that offer services to applicants to draw. And they could and would flood the market with agreements with particular guides who are willing to pay those outside companies more money if they'll apply their clients to book those drawing hunts. So I like to keep Alaskan in good fiscal shape. And I think the guiding industry is an important factor to that. But I really don't want to see us go down a path that could divert more funds that could remain in Alaska to outside corporations.
Thank you, Mr. Tiffany, for your testimony. You bring up an interesting point that what does Cabela's have to do with our guiding program?
In brief, as it stands now, and there are many other companies that do this, they have a service where you pay them and provide them the necessary information, and they will submit applications for drawing hunts throughout the United States. Alaska is only one place. Many of the western states, the only opportunity for a non-resident of that state to hunt is through a drawing process. So they do this service for you, saves you the headache and the confusion of it. How would that play in if we had a drawing system here? I believe would be a company such as that has a huge database of potential clients. They are known worldwide. They can flood any market they want with particular client group. And if they've worked out an agreement with John Doe Guide, listen, if you give us a bigger cut, we'll make sure all those people that we have submitted names for that draw a tag go to you. Now, I have nothing against Cabela's or any other company that is trying to help our national economy. But I do have a very serious problem with a drawing system statewide in Alaska. If a program is not implemented, it's been made clear that the Board of Game will have to make some hard decisions, and one of those considered would be a drawing hunt. And I think outside interest groups would gain more than many other groups within Alaska.
Is the methods that they're using, is that keeping residents from sort of naturally actually drawing permits?
I'm not well versed in the intricacies of the drawing permit process, because none of the areas that I currently guide in do we have a drawing permit process, so my knowledge is rather general. To answer your question, I don't certainly believe it would not prevent a resident from applying or a non-resident from independently applying. But they, for example, if there are 10 non-resident permits and 1,000 applicants apply and 900 of them come from a particular organization that does this service, simple math will say there's probably a better chance that organization's applicants will have a better chance of obtaining some of those permits.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Tiffany. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Wilson?
Are you a member of the...
Excuse me for not answering the question. Yes, I am a member of Alaska Professional Hunters Association.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Tenney. Is there anybody else in the room that would like to testify? Okay, seeing none, go to the off-net, make sort of an exception here. I've got Steve Parent, who's calling in on a satellite phone. I'm sure the guides will appreciate satellite phone time costs a lot of money. So, Mr. Parent.
Yes, I appreciate your exception today. I'm calling from Rainy Pass Lodge, about 125 miles northwest of Alaska in the Alaska Range. Rainy Pass is the oldest hunting lodge in Alaska. It was commemorated by the Senate last year for 75 years in business as a hunting and recreation lodge. And I have been very involved in the guide concession program from day one with trying to get it set up to a group of folks from the Alaska Professional Hunters Association. I served on the board for over 6 years and currently am very involved in the industry. I have some concerns with the concession program. However, I also need to state that I'm in support of the concession program and the need for it in Alaska. I'll give you a little background as to how it may affect business that I've been involved with over the years. I've been guiding since 1977 in Alaska, Master Guide number 123. I currently run a business with my family of five sons and my wife. Four of my boys are guides. One of them registered and the others are assistants and work in our business. I guided on Kodiak Island since 1981. I purchased an area under the old guide area system, and when Osechek took place, I lost that guide area. Had as many as 18 guides applying. It's currently now the most applied for permit system for non-residents and multiple guides in Kodiak on Kodiak Island now. I went from having a business that had five bear hunters a year to the conservation increasing that to seven bear permits a year, and now with the system, I got one permit last year, none this spring. I have almost I've lost our entire business down there because we don't have any consistency. I used to be booked 3 years in advance, and I was one of the highest, right in the top tier of high priced operators. We provided a good quality service with permanent camps, some private property, good accommodations, heat, you know, the whole nine yards. We guided to some of the wealthiest people in the world, as well as the guy that saved up for 4 or 5 years to go on his dream hunt in Alaska. That business is all but gone now, even though the permit system is still in place and helps conservation. It doesn't give a guide any security in his business whatsoever. So I've got hunters waiting to draw permits for several years. I've got guys that have never hunted in there before, have no permanent structure. It's what I refer to as a hobby guide, and there's nothing wrong with a hobby guide. But I think most importantly, the Senate and legislatures need to take into consideration that we're trying to protect an industry that generates a lot of money for the state, a lot of positive representation for hunting in the world. Alaska and Africa are still the two best-known areas in the world with professionals. And in order to protect that, we have to protect the industry. The states that I'm familiar with, I carried a guide license in Colorado for several years, and I guided in Texas many, many years ago. But what I realize is that in those states now, under a permit system, a drawing permit system, there is no stability. You can have a person that is a plumber, an electrician, a rancher, and he may get some people this year to go hunting with him because he got some permits drawn. Next year he didn't, but he's not counting on his livelihood. This business is my entire livelihood. It's what we base our primary income off of for ourselves and my family. So I think we need to protect the industry. I use an analogy that if you were to take all the airplane charter businesses on Lake Hood, they make up a charter industry that helps our folks that come up to be able to travel and see the remote Alaska areas. But a small group of them are in there for business. They're there to survive. They've been there for many years. Their safety and procedurals that are implemented are keeping them in business. There's also a group of hobby pilots, and I have had some of those people approach me. They're in business chartering 1 year. They're all gung-ho. They're traveling around the lake soliciting business. 2 years later, they're selling life insurance and they're out of the business. 3 years later, they're back running around the lake trying to get your business again. That doesn't create stability. There's nothing wrong with it. It gives them an income, a supplemental income. Maybe more importantly for them, it gives them an opportunity to write off their hobby, to have some tax advantages for their airplane and their own personal hunting. But it doesn't give our tourists and our future hunters that want to come to Alaska and their kids and grandkids a stable industry, a business that's sitting there constantly trying to improve and invest in their business to make it better for the people they serve.
And Mr. Perman,
I had permanent structures in Kodiak. It's pretty hard for me to want to go down there, and I have the last couple of years with one hunter here or there continuing to do maintenance on those structures, new doors and windows, new roofs, paint the building, improve my heaters. When I get one hunter a year, it's pretty hard to run that business. And the hobby guys are going to find out that they can't, and pretty soon their wives are going to say, hey, Jack, it's time to get back to work, you know. We're not making any money at this. And somebody else will replace them. Someone else will step in and fill that void. But I think we need to keep a focus on, we need a constant, you know, industry. People that are doing it for their livelihood are going to invest in that business.
Yeah, Mr. Perrin.
Challenge I have with the concession program.
Mr. Perrin.
Ed?
And you've exceeded your time. If you could wrap it up quickly.
Okay. The problem I have as it currently stands is that there is no ability for transferability. I have 15 horses up here. If I go up to feed them tomorrow or in the middle of my guide season, I get kicked in the head and I'm out of commission. I have my son who's registered, a partner here that's registered, my wife that's got an investment in our lodge that needs to continue to run our business. And I may be laid up for a period of time and not be able to guide, but my business and my family livelihood should continue to flow on. That's not taken care of. I know there's a clause in there that some people are working on, but transferability is a must to keep the industry solid. Investment in our business is important, and there's no credit for it. And adjoining areas, we need an industry rep. We've asked DNR for this consistently. So as much as I want a concession program to go in, and I think that we need to support it in the legislature, I think we need to put some parameters on it and get it fixed first. I don't trust that we're going to fix it properly later. Every guide I've talked with, and most of them that have talked and will talk on this, believe and feel the same way. They're afraid to put this thing down because we may lose it. But I think we need to put some restraints on it and make sure that we get the fixes there so the industry stays whole.
Okay.
If we go to a permit business, a permit situation, I'm out of business as the oldest hunting lodge in Alaska, and many other guides that count on this as their livelihood are out as well.
Thank you, Mr. Perrin.
Thank you for your time.
Appreciate your testimony. All right, next up.
Just teasing.
He does like to talk, having flown for him. Next up, we'll go to the Matt CLIO. And first on the docket here is Mr. Israel Payton.
Hello, Chairman and members of the Resources Committee. My name is Israel Payton, and I am a lifelong Alaskan and a registered guide, number 1111. I've guided on state and federal land for 17 years. About 20% of my income comes from guiding, and I usually work for other contracting guides. I am not a member of the APHA, and I believe the first that you have heard a dissenting opinion of House Bill 158. I am in opposition of House Bill 158. Do you want to give DNR the authority to allocate small business in a free market system? Is it currently this administration's policy to grow the government? The question is, are we at carrying capacity for hunting guides in the state? Some say no, some yes. But what are the facts to support or against that? Facts should remain the contributing factor when making important decisions. We have come to this point today mainly based on personal preferences, blanket allegations, and anecdotal information pushed by a strong and loud but small segment of the industry who I'm sure have been lobbying hard in recent. Fact, DNR reported in Appendix C, and I believe I've emailed everyone this, in the year 2000, roughly 4,600 hunters, guided hunters, came to Alaska. In the year 2010, 3,000 guided hunters came. This is a decrease of 1,600 hunters, or 33% of guided hunters. That is a vast reduction, indicating there's less pressure and less crowding on the resource in recent. Now let's talk sheep. I saw Fish and Game's presentation on 14A and 13D, both of which are easy driving distance to big populations of Anchorage in the Mat-Su Valley. The fact, though, is statewide sheep data from the department's website, which I sent to each of you, show that hunter participation and harvest of success of harvest has been very stable, with no recent spikes of over-harvest or increased participation for the last 29 years. Fact. In 1991, DNR proposed an action similar to House Bill 158, which would have limited fishing guides on the Kenai River. The Attorney General's office response was to deny this program. They stated the data supplied to us supports neither the conclusion that there is a problem of overcrowding or of increased fishing pressure, nor the conclusion that limiting the number of guides alone would help solve the problem if it were found to exist. Now, no one's answered this question. I have asked the DNR, and you guys almost asked it the other day, how many hunters coming into the state would this program reduce? Because that is the real problem, non-resident hunters versus residents. Their answer to me is none, if not, or very few. So if that is the case, how is this program designed to alleviate the alleged problem? What this program is a guide competition program. Of course, you would want to be one of the only people to run a business in your area. I understand all their arguments and why they're arguing. Now, in closing, you heard on Monday's hearing that air taxis and transporters are a huge concern, and if guides are restricted, then drop-off hunters will just fill that void. It is not right to restrict one user group when the burden is shared by all. If this committee deems there is a problem and action should be taken, and wildlife and land stewardship are the true concern, which that's where I'm coming from, let's look at it from wildlife and land stewardship, House Bill 158 needs to be amended to say something like this: DNR may not only limit hunting guides, but all commercial operations involved with non-resident hunters, i.e. air taxi and transporters, that do drop-off hunts, and only when DNR has developed a program to cover all commercial user groups simultaneously, this type of program will be allowed. This is right now just a guide-on-guide fight, and as Chairman of Board of Game, Ted Spraker, said, and I'm paraphrasing in his Monday's testimony, the true problem is not a guide problem, it is a people problem, meaning too many hunters. So please look at it from that viewpoint. And as a side note,
Mr. Payne, I do need you to wrap it up, please.
Yep. The proposed program offers no money to the state coffers. The fees are based on paying for administrative cost of the program, and no money goes to the general fund or even to a fish and game fund. So therefore, we would be allocating the state's natural resources to a commercial operation with no direct benefit or royalty going to the state of Alaska and the people of Alaska, which we all own this resource. I encourage you to ask me any questions about this program. I know the ins and outs of it. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Any questions from the committee? Mr. Payton, you gave us your guide number. Also, we're also asking all the guides, number of hunts contracted on average over the years, and percentage of income derived from guiding?
I believe I stated I use it as a supplemental income, roughly 20%. Like a lot of Alaskans, I do various other things, welding, airplane mechanic, no full-time job. And in the recent three years, I have not contracted a hunt, although I do hold a registered guide license in Unit 16 and 19. And once again, I've guided on state land for 17 years and only had one user conflict with another guide in all those years of hunting state land. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Payton. And a reminder for all the other folks at the LIOs and on the off-net, we do need to keep your testimony.
Questions?
Yes.
Yeah.
You need to keep your testimony down to 3 minutes. Next up in Matsu, Peter Barella.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
With apologies to the committee, I do have another conflicting meeting that I have to step off to.
Yeah.
But I just want to let all the people testifying know that my office is monitoring these proceedings and we are paying attention to all the public testimony being offered.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hawker.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Barella, are you there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Please go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity. My name is Peter Barella. The guide license number is 1272. I've been guiding since 1993. I acquired my registered license in 2007. My income is 60 to 70% supplemented by guiding. I am an APHA member, and I do not favor House Bill 158. I sign contracts since I become a registered guide on an average of 2 to 5 contracts a year. Another 6 to 8 working for another guide. I believe the issues are regarding conflict and passing this law, giving DNR the authority, will not have any authority regarding transporters and air taxis. I believe that comes under the FAA. I believe that in regards to regulating our game population is through the Fish and Game Department that's been appointed for that, not the DNR. And I believe with the rogue and pirate guides that are out there are supposed to be regulated and withdrawn from the guiding industry from the Big Game Commercial Services Board. And I think if they would use their authority, we could have some of these guides not in the business anymore that have continuously created problems for the industry. So I really don't see how House Bill 158 will give DNR the authority to control these other matters that are a huge problem with the conflicts that we're having in the few areas in the state on state land. So again, I'm not in favor of House Bill 158, and that's it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barella. Any questions from the committee? Thank you for your testimony. Next up would be Representative Tuck.
Yeah, if you're still there, just real quick. So would you support the bill if it wasn't the Department of Fish and Game?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yeah, you said that one of the reasons why you didn't like this bill is because it should be in the Department of Fish and Game. If it was underneath the Department of Fish and Game, would you support the bill?
No, sir. I believe there are some other issues regarding the bill that need to be changed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Boyle. Ron Payne, you're up next.
Yes. My name is Ron Payne, and I am a registered guide. Thank you for the opportunity. My guide license number is 1286, and fairly new at the guiding industry. Been guiding since 2006, so I haven't been long-term guide like a lot of the people who have testified today already. But I would like to state that I am in favor of something happening, but not. I am definitely opposed to House Bill 158. There needs to be something done. I think all guides agree with that, but this is a bad program for several reasons. Most of today, it seems like a lot of the APH members, and I am not a member of, because I don't feel like they represent what I'm after, and so I've decided not to be a member of them. And it seems like a lot of rhetoric is mostly what's coming from most of the APH members, except for the Mr. Barella, who stated some facts. I think the biggest thing, since my time is limited here today, that I want to say is that I don't think anybody's really thought of the true cost here. The $1.8 million has already been stated. That's just for paper pushing. The agencies under which these regulations are implemented have to foresee the compliancy. DNR lacks funding every year for the programs that already exist. One example,
that I can state is after talking with a local state trooper out of Talkeetna who flew over Cache Creek Mine, which is obviously one of DNR's programs, the mining division, saw devastation there, and he, as a state trooper, had no ability to do any of the to do anything over that. He had no jurisdiction over that. After several complaints from a state trooper, aerial photographs, and months later, DNR finally looked into the violations. They do not have the capabilities, and I want your attention here very quickly. This is going to cost hundreds, I repeat, hundreds of millions of dollars in the foreseeable future. They have one Super Cub that is going to only the Parks and Recreation. It's been in pieces for the last 2 years. They do not even have an aviation program. How in the world do you, if you can just have a little bit of outlook here, look forward towards the what is, has to be implemented when they cannot even have a state trooper that can stop their mining violation. The implications of this are so far-reaching that it's hundreds of millions of dollars over the foreseeable future. You know, 20 years of this is gonna cost billions of dollars to the Alaskan taxpayer. There is no way, like Mr. Perrin said, that this is gonna protect an industry from money that's resourced in and out. There's no way the resources taken in by this can ever offset the cost of implementing this type of a program. And I have many issues, but that's the biggest one that I would like to see you folks take into consideration, being the Resource Committee. Thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Payne. Questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Payne, for taking the time to testify. Next up, we'll go to Kodiak. Tim Beach.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Tim Booch. I'm a 35-year resident of Kodiak, Alaska. I'm a master guide outfitter number 176. I conduct my hunts in three different guide use areas, Unit 8, 9, and 10. I've had two DNR recreational camp permits for my bear and moose hunts since 1996. I also have two U.S. Fish and Wildlife refuge permits. I'm also a member of the APHA. I average about 12 hunts a year. I do participate in drawings. I would like to have my 3 minutes go towards the alternatives that I'd like to offer to this plan, but I am in opposition to 158. I'm also in opposition to the DNR guide use area concession plan. And so let me just mention six alternatives that I'd like to put out here, and this is my tack that I take. Include DNR commercial recreation permit camps in the Big Game Commercial Services Board statute designating special spatial distribution between established guide camps on state land in Game Management Unit 9 and statewide on state land. Article 3, 12 ACC 75.340, professional ethics standards for guides, B, fieldcraft standards, 7, says allow appropriate buffer areas between hunters and camps in order to avoid disrupting hunts and hunting experiences. In Game Management Unit 9, a person holding any class of guide license may not place a camp within 2 miles of a permanent structure or permanent camp being used for big game guide purposes. Permanent structures or permanent cabins are not the only established guide operations on state land anywhere in the state. If the intent of the authors of this statute and of the Big Game Commercial Services Board was to identify where the established guide camps were in Game Management Unit 9, then they could have gotten together with DNR and looked at a map and found where all of the existing DNR camp permits were, and then they could have included this designation as well in the GMU 9 statute. And if it wasn't for the APHA DNR guide concession plan, they could have implemented it statewide. 2, eliminate the 14-day statewide permit. There are a few terms and conditions to those permits, and you certainly cannot prove in a prospectus where you base your operation with this permit. Operators under this class of land permit have contributed a considerable amount of the problem where it exists. 3, demand that the Board of Games stick to the previous 10 years average when allocating percentages to drawing permits. It is my contention that the APHA DNR guide concession program has contributed to the decline in the recognition of the big game guide industry by the Board of Game, as evidenced in their up to 10% non-resident precedent-setting allocation of the Delta sheet permits. If the APHA lobbying effort stop the implementation of the Kodiak model drawing permit guidelines hadn't convinced the Board of Game that the Kodiak model wouldn't work anywhere other than Kodiak, and that the guide concession program would eliminate the need for a fair and equitable and uniform drawing permit guidelines, then the Board of Game would have adopted, one, a statewide drawing permit guideline for all new and existing drawing hunts, and would have honored their policy of the previous 10 years average.
Mr. Booth, I need you to wrap it up.
Well, I'm not close to my 3 minutes yet. I'd like to continue. You're going through 4 minutes. Okay. Demand ethics standards, regulations for residents that mirror guide statutes. Print these in the hunting regs and enforce them with prosecutions, fines, and punishments. Until we address the residents' contribution to the problem, we will find ourselves continually conceding our free market liberties to the federal-style bureaucratic takeover of the rest of the guide industry on state land. Require all commercial transporters providing services to big game sport hunters to have transporter license with occupational licensing, and include commercial transporters in the Article 3 Professional Ethics Standards for Guides Field Craft Standards referred to early in this memo. You could, too, 6, make moose a guide required for non-resident species. I would like to just maybe ask for your indulgence here for some information that has been provided to you on the drawings earlier by an APHA member. I am also an APHA member and have been since 1995. The guide climate analysis that was the result of the Kodiak model being implemented on Kodiak.
Good enough.
Can't.
Thank you. Next up, we're going to Anchorage LIO, Mike McCray.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Can I make a request to the previous speaker to send those suggestions in writing?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity today. My name is Mike McCrary. Can you hear him?
Go ahead, Mr. McCrary.
Okay. I'm familiar with the evolution of the scheme and the guide industry and the history on it. And I'm hoping this bill never moves out of this committee. As you heard on Monday, in 2007, then-Governor Palin directed unelected and political appointed officials at DNR to collaborate with the Alaska Professional Hunters Association to create this program and consider nothing else but APHA's special interests. DNR would like for this committee to believe alternatives have been through a formal vetting process, yet no public meetings, no notes, no committees, no hearings, no agendas, no recorded testimony, nothing exists but the white paper and any evidence alternatives to this program have been legitimately considered. I'd like to speak a little about the role of the Board of Game in this matter. Not a single public proposal has been put through the Board of Game's vetting process that would provide the Board of Game any rational basis to believe that resident hunters and the public in general support DNR's program. Yet, we have letters dating back to 2007 from the Board of Game and have heard time and again testimony from Board of Game members supporting the proposed DNR plan. In complete contrast to that, the Board of Game support for this program, Mr. Spraker pointed out at the hearing on Monday that time after time and for years and now in increasing numbers, the public has put forward proposals that work their way through the Board of Game process to limit the numbers of non-resident hunters. The bottom line, says Mr. Spraker, is the problem is not too many guides, the problem is too many hunters. And that, for all intents and purposes, is the same darn thing the proposals Alaskans have been submitting to the Board of Game for years say. Essentially, Mr. Sprager concluded on Monday that the Board of Game is eventually going to be limiting the number of hunters overall, regardless whether the DNR scheme is implemented or not. So down the road, you can expect that the next bite of the apple APHA is going to be asking for is allocating tags to guides. I'd like to speak a little bit about the cost of this program, and just to point out to you, actually, that the Big Game Commercial Services Board, the appointed board that's responsible for overseeing the guide licensing program, does not even collect enough guide licensing fees to cover the cost of operating this board. So the public's already subsidizing this special interest industry and this program, as has been pointed out to you today, is not going to sustain itself. The wildlife resources can't support it. I'd like to speak a little about these contracts should this thing get implemented. People reference these proposed contracts as leases, permits, a concession, and DNR identifies the contracts as concessions, permits. The legal meaning of each of these words, lease, permit, concessions, are significant. Ironically, there is no such thing as a concessions permit. And after years of meetings and more than $1 million of public funds expended, the fact DNR has had to invent a new legal concept for this scheme is almost laughable.
Okay, Mr. McCray, I need you to wrap things up quickly, please.
One more thing related to contracts. On Monday, Mr. Clark was asked a very good question by Representative Carr about transferability. He did not answer that important question. The question was, who can control one of these contracts? Sell the business, thus transferring ownership of the contract. A corporation cannot obtain a guide license. Under this proposed program, only a person with a guide license can compete. In other words, businesses are not competing for these special rights to hold exclusive commercial use areas on state public lands, but individuals with guide licenses are. So unless the agreement is ultimately entered into with the guide holding the guide license, big box outfits who are disqualified in the first place from competing for these contracts could end up controlling all contracts eventually.
Hey, Mr. McCray, I need you to wrap it up quickly.
The Board of Game's long history of demonstrating a pattern of showing favor to the commercial hunting industry, because as Mr. Sprecher effectively said, the perception is we need the money, is an unsustainable wildlife conservation management practice. The problem is not too many guides. The problem is too many hunters. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McCray. Appreciate your testimony. A reminder to everybody in the LIOs and on the off-net, please try to keep it to 3 minutes. We have a lot of people to testify, and we do not have very much time. About 20 minutes left is all. Next up, at Anchorage LIO, Chris Brown.
Yeah, I'd certainly keep it to 3 minutes. My name is Chris Branham. I'm Master Guide number 65. I don't think anybody in this industry has been guiding longer than I have here, so I should have something important to say to you people. The number of clients I have and the number of guides I take every year, fortunately in the last 5 or 6 years there hasn't been very many, but 100% of my business is related to guiding. Unfortunately, or fortunately for me, 80% of it is related to fish guiding, so I'm in the outdoor business. And we thank the legislature for a recommendation of the oldest hunting lodge in Alaska, and I'm part of that family that started it in 1937. At the very beginning, I would like to say that if Bill 158 is to give DNR the power to limit guides and the industry, then I'm not in favor. The DNR's responsibility is natural resources. Hunting has absolutely got nothing to do with natural resources. And I can tell you one little issue here. There are a few issues that this program is, you know, is unacceptable. One is, I know it for certain it's going to be unconstitutional. That's going to be a number one big issue. Number two, it limits competition. And number three, it prevents free enterprise. Number four, it does not generate revenue for the state. And if limited concessions are given, and number three, one thing I want to mention is very briefly is that any guy that has a concession under a federal permit should only deserve one or two. If he's going to try and get some more in this under this program, I think it should not be allowed. That's way too many. They have exclusive privilege, a highly exclusive privilege for having federal concessions. It does not prevent user conflict. It does not ensure quality hunting experiences. It does not. It also does not allow for people with limited budgets to hunt. How many minutes have I got left?
You've got
45
seconds.
All right. Just wanted to be under 30 minutes, sir. Here's my proposal for you guys. The DNR is a land management issue, and I'm suggesting that you have a guide, a land program that gives state leases. That's what's in the process right now. It allows you to generate revenue, gives leases, it tells you where all the guides are going to be, and it also will support, if you do like they do with the fishing industry, give you a guide, what they call we have a sports fish guide program, and you're supposed to carry this logbook with you every day and report it. That should be applied to this program. So I think that is one of the major issues you need to follow through with to get the DNR to have, you know, to have land issued permits, and you can resolve the rest of the issues later. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Brown. Appreciate you taking the time to testify. Any questions from committee? Okay, thank you, Mr. Brown. Next we go to the Fairbanks LIL. First up on the list is Smokey Don Duncan.
Good afternoon, Resource Committee members. My name is Smokey Don Duncan, Master Guide number 136. I've been guiding for 20 years. I take 20-plus clients per year. My sole source of income. And unlike many of those people who have testified, particularly from APHA, I guide on state land. All of my guide areas are on state land. You cannot pay me to take a federal area. In fact, the federal system causes a lot of the problems and is known for favoring operators who take fewer animals. And that in itself pushes the hunting pressure on the state lands. The majority of guides who want and support a guide concession program actually do most of their business on federal lands. 50% of the original supporters of the guide concession plan no longer want it, particularly the way DNR has drafted it. Overall, the vast majority of guides do not support a guide concession plan, particularly this one. It has too many fatal flaws. If House Bill 158 passes, DNR will have no incentive to fix the program. If air taxis are not required to be and transporters are not required to be part of this program, then it will accomplish nothing, but it will put 50% of the guides out of business. Furthermore, the program will fail in court on multiple fronts, resulting in a large waste of money and time for everyone. Look at your pie chart, one guide use area per guide. It's not reasonable, justified, or anything. 100 guides with three guide use area means 80% of the guides are out of business for no good reason. No realistic study has been done to justify any part of this program. No other industry would be subject to this kind of abuse. I have emailed you two long letters with lots of truth and facts, which you haven't been told by a lot of influential people so far. Please take time to read those two letters, and when you do, you will not vote for House Bill 158. Please feel free to call me anytime for any kind of advice. For sure, this is a resource grab. Parts of Unit 17 has more guides than anywhere else, with 17 guides in one guide use area where I hunt. And we have had very few conflicts with residents or guides. 90% of the complaints that I heard when I used to do the show circuit were about transporters and not guides. In my case, the biggest industry to my area and the game has been done by inaction by the Board of Game and Fishing Game. And finally, board members, repeating a lie over and over and over doesn't make it true. Demand proof for these accusations of crowding. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Duncan. Any questions from committee? Thank you for taking the time, and thank you for being on time, Mr. Duncan. Next up, Pete Buist.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on HB 158. I hold Master Guide License number 79. I've been guiding for about 40 years. I have a somewhat unique perspective on this issue since I'm also retired from 30 years working for the Department of Natural Resources and have over the years served several terms on the Guide Licensing and Control Board, the Big Game Commercial Services Board, as well as Governor Cooper's Task Force on Guiding and Game. I certainly agree that there are some areas of guide overcrowding, mostly in some sheep areas, but this is not the fault of the guides. The Osacek decision and the policies of the Department of Commerce have created this problem. Official state policies, such as the one to allow and encourage non-residents to become licensed guides in Alaska, and insisting that it's more important for the guide testing system to be more egalitarian rather than a test of knowledge and ability, are the real culprits. Instead of addressing the real issues, HB 158 authorizes DNR to design a program to, quote, limit the number of guides working on state land. And, of course, DNR has already designed such a program, and judging from the introduction of this bill, apparently without any statutory authority. Ironically, the system DNR has come up with will have exactly the opposite effect. After 30 years of working there, I know the mindset at DNR. And knowing what goes on behind closed doors at DNR as well as I do, I can assure you that they see this simply as an opportunity to put some guides out of business and grab onto a significant budget booster, likely with program receipts to perpetuate their control. In my experience, most DNR employees have neither the expertise nor the proper attitude to fairly administer a guide concession program. Experience has shown that the Fairbanks office of DNR has done a pretty good job of dealing with guide operations in the past, but guides south of the Alaska Range have been subjected to a lot of ridiculous and unreasonable bureaucratic BS. If this bill is passed and DNR is authorized to expand their control, this will no doubt get worse. The program as designed by DNR shows once again that most DNR employees do not have more than a vague understanding of what is entailed in running a guide business. Worse, they seem to assume that every guide is a millionaire and needs to share their fortune with DNR. As designed, the program will financially prohibit and eventually phase out all but the largest operations. Ironically, this could force guides to take an increasing number of clients onto state land in order to pay the fees. This, of course, would exacerbate the crowding problems even further. And that, in a nutshell, is a problem with this bill. I hope the committee will consider what the bill and the project really do instead of just listening to the large-scale guides and DNR bureaucrats that will benefit if it passes.
Thank you, Mr. Buist. Any questions from the committee? Okay, right now I've got to make another small exception. I've got a gentleman who's trying to get on an airplane in Anchorage. Mr. Sanfiges, are you on?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, do you hear me?
Yes, sir, I do. You've got 3 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, my name is Sam Feges, born and raised in Alaska, Master Guide number 73. I'm also an APHA board member. Guiding is my full-time operation, full-time occupation. I guide between 30 to 40 clients a year. I guide in the south end of Kodiak. I guide east of Cordova. Been guiding Cordova for over 30 years and Kodiak for over 20. I'm in favor of the House Bill 158. I'm a little cut on time here, but I'll speak real quick here. The guidance concession program is good, not just for the guiding industry, but all Alaska. Resident hunters, the rules of
subsistence users, but most of all, the long-term benefit is the wildlife. Putting the guide concession program in place will also reduce the impact on the present state guide use areas that are currently overcrowded. And I know a lot of people say they're not, but I know they are, because I've been in the business for a long time and I hear a lot of stories. This in turn will also create less impact on Alaska's resources and wildlife. One thing I wanted to mention in closing is over 30 years ago, I applied for a state commercial lease for guiding operations. I was one of three people. I have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in my five-acre parcel that I lease from the state, and I'm paying on time every year. As for the fees, I travel all over the world. I am also a hunter in other places. I'm not just a guide. And it's a normal process to pay the fees to the country or the government. So the fees that the state is going to charge will be passed on to the client. It's not coming out of the guide's pocket. I have to close here. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Fugis. Any questions from committee? Thank you very much for taking your time. If you do have additional comments that you'd like to submit, please feel free to email them to my office.
Well, thank you very much for the time, Mr. Chairman and committee. Sorry to cut you guys short. Bye.
Catch your flight. Thank you. All right, going back to Fairbanks, Chris Zwolinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Chris Zwolinski, Master Guide 145. I'm proudly not a member of APHA. I've been contracting. I contract about 4 to 6 hunts a year. 60% of my business is from guiding. I've been a proponent for guide use areas for years because I do guide on exclusively on state land. I've been guiding I've been contracting hunts for about 24 years in the same area on state land. In the first half of my contracting career, it was steady. I think I self-regulated how many animals I took. Now, the second half of my contracting career, watched the influx of guides that come in, all aircraft owners, and pretty much going wherever they wanted to with the aircraft. And I watched the population decline. So I, being a self-regulator, started taking less animals, while they, unfortunately, increased. So I guess my point is, I think there needs to be some sort of a regulatory system. I'm not sure what it is. House Bill 158 is not the answer. It's pushing regulation that is, it's got way too many flaws. And we've, without going over the same issues that has already been talked over, you can see there's many people have brought the flaws up, and I'd be more than happy to outside my 3 minutes in another time. But I feel that the state is going to rubber stamp it. I'm afraid the state's going to rubber stamp it, and I don't want to see that happen. They're going to push it through and say, yep, we did our job, on to the next item. And there's got to be some sort of regulation. It's a start. The DNR program is a start, but it's got too many flaws. It can't happen the way it is. And the issue of, I've only heard it brought up twice so far, the issue of the transporters, limiting transporters, has got to be addressed. It is huge. There's no regulation on it. Has a huge impact on the wildlife. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Zwolinski. Any questions for Mr. Zwolinski? And you mentioned that you don't have any, that you guide exclusively on state land. Have you never investigated going to for one of those federal concessions?
I have applied for federal concessions. In the two open periods that they've had, I have applied and I have not been successful. It's a huge competing force. And a lot of guys, I mean, there's, now you're opening up a whole other can. I mean, I could give you reasons, but people are hiring professionals to write their theses for them. and I can't afford that.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Zielinski. Next up, we'll have Al Barrett, and then following Mr. Barrett, Tom Kirstein, and then we're going to have to wrap it up for today. So, Mr. Barrett, go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'd like to just point out, I'm a Class A Assistant Guide 765. I'd like to point out some subliminal misinformation that's been going on. First of all, it's the DNR's overall mission to manage state lands for multiple use and maximum benefit of Alaskans. There's been a lot of discussion of overcrowding and underutilization in some areas. This is a direct effect on the DNR not managing the land. Why you have concentration of hunter effort and guides and residents is because the habitat in those areas are indicable to producing game for people. In other areas like the Kenai that's going to be discussed here this week down at the Board of Game, where the DNR hasn't taken any action on manipulating habitat for moose populations down there, we have to reduce the population estimates or population goals on moose because the habitat won't support it. Another failure on the DNR not to manipulate habitat. So they should be looking at what they're supposed to be doing. Another point that the DNR is not doing and overcrowding and utilization is access. They've limited a lot of access to certain areas, and so when you constrict access to a certain few trails, you get a lot of crowding and you get a lot of problems. Again, DNR is not utilizing their already authority to maximize and benefit Alaskans. There's a discussion that not having this program would decrease incentive to practice wildlife conservation. That's already being taken care of at the Board of Game. The Board of Game manages on a sustained yield basis to a maximum sustained yield basis. They set restrictions on antlers, full curl sheep, sex, bag limits, and dates that the hunts are being conducted. So a guide can only work within what the Board of Game has already directed. They got a full curl restriction, it's a full curl restriction. And they manage that sheep conservation on a sustained yield basis. I think the biggest thing that may be in a lawsuit that if this was to pass is the DNR is going to be allocating permits on the applicant based on the applications of how much game the applicant will take in his perspectives. Sort of like the federal deal, the less you take, the less imprint you make on the land, the more favorable your points will be and success of getting it. When it comes to the allocation issues, it's very clear through the Board of Game. The Board of Game allocates game and not the DNR. The Board of Game is very clear on its priorities and who and when people can hunt, and non-residents are usually at the lower end of that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Barrett. Appreciate you taking the time to testify.
Can I just say one other thing? I'm a self-employed person, and there's not one state program trying to protect my business.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Duly noted. Next up, and the final for today, public testifier, Tom Kirstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, this is Tom Kirstein. I've been a licensed master guide number 98. I've been in the business for, this is my 39th year. I started hunting in the early 1970s, and I also hunt on Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge, two areas on state land, one on the Alaska Peninsula and one in interior Alaska in Unit 20. 20-04, and I have this season will be 40 years in that particular area, knowing the history of it pretty well. I contract typically about 20 clients a year, though on state land I've reduced that number by a few hunters the last years because of all the pressure. Prior to the Osacek decision, 1988, 20-04 was made up of five guides.
spread out in an area of about 2,000 square miles. Today, 2004 is a much smaller area, about 1,000, about half that size, 1,200 square miles. And there's over 20 guides now operating in that geographic area. What happened through the 90s, the economy had improved in the United States. The Osacek decision left a period of time through 1992. The federal government came to the board, the guide board at that time. Every year they told the board that if you don't address this problem, we're going to take management from the state on federal lands starting in 1992. The state of Alaska, the legislature, and all those individuals neglected to act. We could have fixed this problem back at that time. Restricted areas were thrown out. Supreme Court told us how to fix it. Anyways, we're now living with federal control on those lands. 72% of Alaska's federal land. State land has picked up the residual, and through the 90s of deregulation, here we are today with a problem. This has been going on for some time. And as I call them, the 90 guides, or the guides that came under deregulation, and it became very easy for new guides to be licensed, and they needed a place to go. The only place to go was state land. What I'd like to see the state do is fix the problem. Look at the future. This industry is worth at least one-third of what is generated by the Division of Tourism. Let's take care of it. Let's look for the future and resolve the problem. This may not be the perfect venue, but it is a good venue. This has been something that DNR has been working on a number of years, trying to refine and to solve this issue. And we need to, as a state, I would like to see the state do what's in best interest for the state to allow the industry to go forward in the future. This is a unique industry. It's a renewable resource that we're dealing with, and it needs to be managed. You cannot have an unlimited number of people using a limited resource. And I've enjoyed the very best, and there's no reason why we can't continue this into the future. And I appreciate your listening and the time and effort, and I'd like your honest efforts to resolve the problems. Thank you.
Hey, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kirstein, and thank you to all the members of the public who have provided testimony. We will not be closing public testimony, and we will expect to try to finish up with the at least the dozen or so folks that are currently on our list on Friday. We'll meet again at Friday at 1 o'clock on our agenda, House Joint Resolution 9 regarding the mining and processing of rare earth elements, and House Bill 129, oil and gas exploration and development areas. For members of the committee, plan on having amendments on House Bill 158 ready to go on Monday, so you'll need to get them in, again, 24 hours prior. With that, any questions from the committee? We're adjourned.